Thursday, the 10th of April, 2025, and time again for weekly reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you news of interest to our veterans and military community here in Arizona. Today we have news from our military news website, stripes.com, and others, as well as the publications and websites of our veteran service organizations, and of course from the va.gov website, news.va.gov. Starting out with some articles from Stars and Stripes and their official website, stripes.com, we have this headline: troops who refused COVID vaccines have until April 2026 to pursue reinstatement in the service, Pentagon says. This is by Matthew Adams of Stars and Stripes from the 8th of April, Washington. The Pentagon and service branches are ramping up efforts to get the word out that service members who refuse to take the coronavirus vaccine and want to return to the military have until next April to pursue reinstatement, a senior defense official said Tuesday. The department is eager to welcome back those who are impacted by that vaccine mandate, said Tim Dill, performing the duties of Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. They never should have had to leave military service, and the department is committed to assisting them in their return. The Army has reenlisted more than 23 soldiers who were dismissed for refusing to take the vaccine, according to the Associated Press. About 400 soldiers have expressed interest in returning, and about 100 are in the application process. More than 8,000 service members were discharged from the military for refusing to get the vaccine for religious or other reasons. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth on Tuesday shared the Army's news by posting on X that many more coming back soon. Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell on Tuesday also posted on X that the deadline for service members to seek reinstatement is April the 1st, 2026. We're working hard to make sure each of them receives clear information and support throughout the process, he said. Their service mattered then, and it still matters now. About a half dozen sailors have expressed interest or requested additional information on reinstatement opportunities, a Navy spokesperson said. The Air Force on Monday began outreach to airmen who left the service. Former airmen will be contacted by mail, email if possible, and by phone to be provided with more information, the Air Force said. The outreach will explain the streamlined process as well as the requirement for a 4-year service commitment upon reinstatement. April the 7th was the day targeted by the Office of the Secretary of Defense for the service-wide outreach to begin, an Air Force spokesperson said. The Air Force did not have numbers to provide on airmen who have expressed interest in returning. Since Monday, 40 Marines have completed the initial questionnaire in the first step of the reinstatement process, a service spokesperson said. The service expects the number will increase as outreach continues. The Navy on Tuesday said sailors who voluntarily left and are reinstated will return to their previous rank at the time of their separation and must commit to a minimum of 2 years of active service. During President Donald Trump's inauguration speech, he said he would sign an executive order reinstating all service members with full back pay kicked out for refusing the coronavirus vaccine. The vaccine mandate was an unfair, overbroad, and completely unnecessary burden on our service members, according to the Trump executive order signed in January. Further, the military unjustly discharged those who refused the vaccine regardless of the years of service given to our nation after failing to grant many of them an exemption that they should have received. Federal government redress of any wrongful dismissals is overdue. Former Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin ordered in August 2021 that all active duty, National Guard and Reserve troops be vaccinated against the coronavirus or face separation. Troops at the time with a health condition incompatible with the vaccine could get a waiver. Additionally, troops with religious beliefs that prohibit the use of vaccines could seek exemption. The order was rescinded January 2023. 2 years ago, the military services sent out notices to all troops discharged for refusing the vaccine, advising them they could return to the military. Just 113 reenlisted. Dill emphasized the difference between this policy compared to previous ones is the back pay, and those who return will be assessed for the medical retention standard rather than the traditional accession standards when you go through an initial recruitment. The back pay only applies to those who returned under the new policy, Dill added. At this time, there's no discussion about extending the deadline past April the 1st. We anticipate that that will be enough time to effectively communicate the opportunity to every impacted service member and give them time to make the decision whether or not they want to express interest, Dill said. That's troops who refused COVID vaccines have until April 2026 to pursue reinstatement in the service, Pentagon says. We turn now to an article by Linda F. Hershey from the 8th of April. Toxic exposed veterans push for more VA coverage at Democrat-led event. Washington. Dave Crate, a former Air Force sergeant at a Nevada installation where nuclear bombs were tested, developed tumors in his brain and throughout his body years after he worked as a military police officer at the facility in the 1980s. But Crate, 60, said it was not until he began connecting on social media with former military buddies that he served with at the Nevada test and training range that he learned several of them also had tumors and their wives experienced multiple miscarriages as his wife did. Crate traveled from his Las Vegas home to meet with lawmakers Tuesday and push for the Department of Veterans Affairs for the first time to provide health care and survivor benefits for veterans exposed to radiation while serving at the classified installation. Legislation was introduced in February to support the additional coverage, he said. Crate joined a discussion held by Democrats on the House and Senate Veterans Affairs Committees that focused on exposures to hazardous materials at U.S. military bases. The informal talk held at a House office building was organized by Representative Mark Takano of California and Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, the top Democrat on each committee. Lawmakers said their goal was to draw attention to efforts by Democrats to expand coverage under the 2022 PACT Act, as President Donald Trump's administration orders sweeping staff cuts across the VA. Takano argued the cuts will impact the delivery of benefits and compensation to veterans. The PACT Act is under attack, Takano said about the Sergeant First Class Heath Robinson honoring our promises to address Comprehensive Toxics Act that provides benefits for veterans sickened from exposures to hazardous materials. Republican lawmakers did not take part in Tuesday's discussion. More than a dozen veterans offered their firsthand accounts of experiences serving at military bases in the United States, where they were exposed to a variety of harmful substances, including industrial solvents, chemicals in firefighting foams, and mold in housing. Crate said he'd been unable to get VA coverage for his radiation exposure while at the Nevada installation because the site where he served was secret. Nuclear testing ended in 1992, but the site is still contaminated, he said. The Defense Department does not acknowledge the site or the nuclear tests that were conducted there, Crate said. I am asking Congress to please allow us to get the benefits every other veteran earned. We're not asking to be special, but to be treated equal, he said. Many of the veterans said they have faced lengthy battles trying to obtain information about the toxic exposures, as well as qualifying for service and benefits. Takano said there is a need for greater focus on toxic exposures at U.S. military installations. We must push back against the idea that service members are only in harm's way in war zones, he said. Invited participants included veterans and several nonprofit groups such as Torchlight Initiative, The Invisible Enemy, and Burn Pits 360 that advocate for veterans with toxic exposures. Mandy Feint, a major in the Army, discussed her experiences serving at Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam in Hawaii, the site of a large jet fuel spill in 2021. Feint lived in a home on Ford Island at the time. The fuel seeped into the drinking water system at the base without families on the base knowing about it, she said. The Navy did not capture all the fuel and did not tell us we were slowly being poisoned, Feint said. The drinking water system serves about 93,000 people who are predominantly military families, she said. Feint said she had to beg the military to test family members when her children became sick after the spill. I wanted to know what my children consumed, she said. Access to basic clean water should be a human right. Feint said her family experienced chronic health problems that they continue to deal with today. The VA was later ordered by Congress to conduct a study on the human impact, but that's yet to be done, she said. More than 3,500 U.S. military installations have some form of contamination, said Jared Hayes, senior policy analyst at the Environmental Working Group, a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. He estimated the total cost for the cleanup as $50 billion. Crate now runs a nonprofit called The Invisible Enemy, which advocates for the VA to provide medical services and compensation for service members who experience radiation exposure at the Nevada Test and Training Range. I want to get benefits to those who serve, the veterans and employees, said Crate, who started the organization in April 2023. We're basically being denied benefits. It's the right thing for Congress to do. And that's Toxic Exposed Veterans. Push for more VA coverage at Democrat-led event. Our next headline, we have great friends, Germans and American soldiers honor World War II dead in Grafenwehr. This is by Matthew M. Burke of Stars and Stripes. From the 9th of April, Grafenwehr, Germany. On April 8, 1945, hundreds of American bombers unleashed a wave of ordnance over this Bavarian village, destroying much of a sprawling military training base and setting surrounding buildings ablaze. 80 years to the day, U.S. soldiers who now run the training area came together with their hosts in the old town to honor the World War II dead, as well as show a commitment to peace and stability on the European continent. Large ceremonies that recall World War II and the Allied advance are a rarity in much of Germany. It's a different story in a handful of rural towns like Grafenwehr, where residents have forged decades of deep relations with American forces. On Tuesday, about 100 German civilians, soldiers, and firefighters joined leaders from U.S. Army Garrison Bavaria and the 7th Army Training Command for a service at the Ascension of Mary Church. They followed with a march to the town hall where they laid wreaths at a war memorial. Afterward, they walked to the nearby cultural and military museum to hear some of the last survivors recount their memories. Hans Heindel was a 6-year-old when the bombs fell. After surviving a prior attack in the basement of the family home, he and the rest of his family members fled to Freyung, about 10 miles south. Thank God, as you see, the house is still standing, he said as he showed an old picture of it. The war came to Grafenwehr with American air raids on April 5th and April 8th, 1945, according to local historian Gerald Morgenstern's book, Grafenwehr Training Area, Yesterday and Today. During the initial raid, bombers first attacked around 11 a.m. from the east, striking the Mark Forest. The bombs narrowly missed the German army's largest poison gas depot, which was hidden in the woods. A strike on the 3 million gas grenades and projectiles would have been enough to extinguish life in northern Oberpfalz region, Morgenstern said. The bombers then struck the northern part of the main camp. 74 people were killed, including 15 civilians. 3 days later, over 200 B-17 bombers from the 3rd Air Division hit the German base and town for nearly 2 hours with conventional and firebombs, Morgenstern said. Over 200 buildings were destroyed and 3,000 residents lost their homes. 11 civilians were killed, along with hundreds of German soldiers and prisoners of war, though the exact number is not known. Civilians rode out the storm in cellars and basements. The buildings along Alte Amberger Street, just outside Gate 1 today, were destroyed. Soldiers from the 11th Armored Division faced little resistance when they entered the town on April 19th. The German commander of the training area, known to the Germans at the time as the Grafenwehr Fortress, surrendered the following morning. U.S. forces began training on the approximately 90 square miles of live fire and training ranges the following year. The training area's role and importance expanded during the Cold War. Buildups to support a brigade-sized element and combat brigade team occurred on nearby Rose Barracks in Wilsach in the 1980s and 20 years later on the Tower Barracks. Today, it is the Army's largest permanent European training area where U.S. and NATO forces hone their tactics for a variety of global missions. Standing in front of the Town Hall Training Command head, Brigadier General Stephen Carpenter spoke of the importance of remembering and learning from the past. He also reiterated the U.S. commitment to Germany and the people of Grafenwehr. Alex Richter, the chief of the Grafenwehr Fire Department, said that in these times, events like this keep us grounded. We need this ceremony, he said, turning his attention to the soldiers in attendance. We have great friends. That's We Have Great Friends, Germans and American Soldiers Honor World War II Dead in Grafenwehr. Next, from Stripes.com, we have this article by Linda F. Hershey. From the 7th of April, VA employees offered a second chance for deferred resignation. Washington. The Department of Veterans Affairs has renewed its offer of deferred resignations, telling employees that they must respond by April 30th to qualify. VA Secretary Doug Collins wrote in an email sent to employees Friday evening that the agency was extending an offer of deferred resignation or retirement prior to a reduction in the workforce that will take place later in the fiscal year. Employees approved for the program will receive full pay and benefits through September 30th to the end of the fiscal year, Collins said. The program opened Monday and will end at 5 p.m. April the 30th. Other federal departments recently announced they are offering a second round of deferred resignation opportunities to employees. They include the Defense Department, Small Business Administration, and the House and Urban Development Department. The VA expects to decrease 15% of its personnel, according to Collins, after an initial round of layoffs in February targeted probationary workers across the federal workforce. The agency employs 470,000 people. VA's goal is to reorganize the agency to improve productivity and efficiency through a mass reduction in personnel, Collins wrote in the email. Employees approved for the program will not be subject to layoffs under a reduction in force or other premature separation, he said. Reorganizing the VA will result in better customer service and convenience for everyone the department exists to serve, Collins said. The layoffs also align with an order by President Donald Trump to downsize the federal workforce. Qualifying employees who opt into the resignation and retirement program will receive immediate deferred resignation or retirement, according to a separate VA memo issued Friday titled Office of the Chief Human Capital Officer Bulletin. The bulletin details the purpose and procedures for the Deferred Resignation and Retirement Program. The Office of Personnel Management granted the VA permission to offer early retirement to qualifying employees, according to the bulletin. More information on qualifying for and taking early retirement will be published shortly, Collins wrote in his email to employees. The effective date of a resignation or retirement must be by September 30th, the bulletin stated. A deferred resignation program that the Office of Personnel Management offered federal workers in February also enabled qualifying employees to be placed on paid administrative leave through September the 30th. Administrative leave is an administratively authorized absence from duty without loss of pay or change to leave, according to the Office of Personnel Management website. Deferred resignation at the VA is available to full-time employees whose jobs are not considered critical for the agency to fulfill its mission, according to the bulletin. Essential roles typically involve personnel who provide direct care to veterans or who support the direct care of veterans. The VA bulletin included a list of roles ineligible for the deferred resignation program, including medical personnel, police, crisis responders, and pharmacists. VA employees approved for deferred resignation cannot go on administrative leave prior to the agreement being approved and signed, the memo said. But federal workers terminated under a reduction in force or layoffs might be eligible for severance pay, according to an Office of Personnel Management fact sheet on the agency's website. Severance pay is authorized for covered full-time and part-time employees who are involuntarily separated from federal service and who meet other conditions of eligibility, according to the agency. But qualifying employees who accept deferred resignations are not eligible for severance pay. An involuntary separation is a job termination initiated by the employer for reasons other than inefficiency, where inefficiency means unacceptable performance or conduct that leads to a separation, according to the agency. Workers must have been in continuous service in one or more civilian federal positions for at least 12 months without a break in service of more than 3 calendar days. That's VA employees offered a second chance for deferred resignation. Next, we have Library of Congress still collecting Vietnam vets' memories 50 years after war ended. This is by Seth Robeson of Stars and Stripes from the 3rd of April. When Jack Danner hit the beach in a landing craft on his first day as an American soldier in Vietnam in 1965, he expected to see bullets flying. As we pulled into Vietnam, everyone was given the magazine with live ammunition. You realize this is the real banana, he recalled in a 2003 video interview. On the beach, he found not the enemy, but the top U.S. commander in Vietnam, Army General William Westmoreland, said Danner, a former first lieutenant who served with Company A, 2nd Battalion, 5th Cavalry Regiment. Danner's recollections are among 27,000 Vietnam veterans' recordings, videos, photographs, drawings, letters, and other documents stored by the Library of Congress's Veterans History Project in a collection that's still growing even as America prepares to mark the 50th anniversary on April 30th of the war's end. The project began in 2000 as a grassroots effort to collect and make accessible the firsthand narratives of U.S. military veterans, according to project spokesman Travis Bickford. The backbone of our collection is oral history, he told Stars and Stripes by phone Wednesday. Future generations can hear directly from those who served in their own words. Veterans of World War I through recent conflicts and peacekeeping missions are included in the project, according to the Library of Congress website. Their recollections are available at the library in Washington, D.C., or at its website. Curated collections include In Country, Stories from the Vietnam War, which presents stories from 16 veterans. Each of the 2.7 million Americans who served in country during the Vietnam War had a unique experience shaped by a vast array of factors, perhaps especially the place or places in which they served, the library states on its website. The Vietnam collection includes stories from veterans dispatched to locations ranging from Saigon to Khe San, from the waters off the coast of Vietnam to the skies above it. Personal Snapshots, Picturing the Vietnam War, features candid amateur photographs taken by soldiers, sailors, and Marines. It includes hundreds of photographs, letters, and tape recordings sent home by Marine Lance Corporal Mark Ryan Black, who is stationed in Quang Tri Province, Vietnam, with a combined action company. Black was killed by enemy fire during an attack on his compound on August 14, 1967. In Vietnam War, Looking Back, veteran Tom Hagel explained, "When we think of wars, whether it's Vietnam or any other war, we think of it as a unitary subject, but there are millions of Vietnam Wars." Typically, each video recording of a veteran was collected by a volunteer and lasts at least 30 minutes. The project also collects things such as old photographs and diaries, Bickford said. The late Vietnam War correspondent, Joseph Galloway, who co-wrote the book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, with Lieutenant General Hal Moore, conducted some of the veteran interviews in the collection, Bickford said. The sort of people who listen to the recordings are researchers, students, filmmakers, and authors or family members who want to hear their loved one's voice again, said Bickford, an Army veteran who served in Germany and Iraq. Documentary makers from the History Channel and the National Geographic have accessed the collection, he said. Filmmaker Ken Burns, who made the 10-part 2017 television series The Vietnam War, has also researched the collection, he said. Interviews from the collection have been quoted in hundreds of books, Bickford added. Technology means there's a lot of firsthand recordings from the front lines of recent conflicts, but that wasn't necessarily happening during the Vietnam War, he said. That's what makes this project important, he said, collecting all these stories from the past. In that article, Library of Congress still collecting Vietnam vets' memories 50 years after war ended. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. You're listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you ever wanted to listen to a Sun Sounds of Arizona production or program when it's not streaming, that option's available to you by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, sunsounds.org, and you can select individual programs or you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona as it streams over the internet. That option's also available to you if you download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, which is available for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store or from the Apple App Store for your iPad or iPhone. And finally, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Echo or Dot. Well, let's turn now to a magazine of one of our veteran service organizations, the American Legion magazine from April. This article is entitled Why the Dole Act Matters and is by Sri Benson. A Gold Star husband shares why the new law is a victory for veterans and their caregivers. How long do we have without treatment? 3 months. That was Army Corporal Katie Benson's introduction to the veterans' healthcare system. Katie had just been diagnosed with stage 4 biphasic mesothelioma. As her husband and caregiver, I was her partner in the life and death challenges to come. Most toxic exposure for veterans of the global war on terrorism came from our own equipment, including open-air pits, where solid waste, trash, chemicals, medical supplies, and spent munitions were burned. Other exposures were just as harmful. Service members at Karshe Khan Abad, or K2, in Uzbekistan encountered depleted uranium. Thousands all involved in Operation Tomodachi in 2011 faced radiation after the Fukushima nuclear accident. Katie's deployment to Camp Arifjan, Kuwait, put her near an open-air asbestos pit. The average age for a mesothelioma diagnosis is 72. In 2018, at 35, Katie was told by VA that her cancer was due to normal U.S. exposures. Her service connection claim was denied. Katie and her doctors fought relentlessly, using data and maps to prove her exposure was caused by her service. Mesothelioma has a known cause, asbestos. Most cancers do not. Asking veterans to prove the source of their exposure is cruel and often impossible. The PACT Act, signed in August 2022, changed that by granting presumptive service connection to many respiratory conditions, lifting the burden of proof from veterans. It also allows VA to expand the list, now including leukemia for K2 veterans. This victory was hard-fought. American Legion staff and other veteran service organizations pressured Congress to act. As others fought for her benefits, Katie fought for her life. We traveled across the country from Sloan Kettering in New York to MD Anderson in Houston, chasing the latest treatments and clinical trials. Whenever possible, she stayed in Portland, Oregon, our home, taking infusions at the France Oncology Clinic with a view of the city. Her doctors marveled at her grit, which embodied the spirit of the American veteran. During her final treatment in March 2022, the stress of caregiving while working full-time overwhelmed me. At 37, I suffered Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, broken heart syndrome. Forced to quit my job, I became Katie's full-time caregiver. Katie entered hospice soon after. Except for weekly nurse visits, we were alone. I carried her room to room and administered morphine every 3 hours to keep her comfortable. She endured her final months with incredible resilience, never complaining despite the pain. Our Multnomah County Veteran Service Officer, VSO, encouraged us to apply for the VA Caregiver Program, meant to support caregivers like me. But an eligibility algorithm ruled that Katie, on her deathbed, was not sick enough because she still had the ability to feed, clothe, and bathe herself. Our county VSO secured a waiver based on her hospice status, but the initial denial devastated us. Katie died in my arms July 9th at 1:45 p.m. I sat by her side recounting our adventures together and reading the prologue from The Lord of the Rings, her favorite book. I told her, "I love you," after each breath she took, because I didn't know which would be the last. I wanted to make sure the last sound she heard was my voice, her last sight, my eyes, and her last touch, my hands. The day after her funeral, I flew to Washington, D.C. to join others in demanding better care for toxic-exposed veterans through passage of the PACT Act. Katie's struggle to prove her invisible wounds were service-connected was unnecessary and heartbreaking. The PACT Act was a major step forward, but not perfect. Since then, few bills intended to help veterans and their families have passed. Many did not even get the dignity of a vote. This changed last year when several stalled bills were combined into the Senator Elizabeth Dole 21st Century Veterans Health Care and Benefits Improvement Act. The American Legion held press conferences, sent leadership, signed letters, and with allies visited all 211 House Democrats in 24 hours to push for passage. Senate approval followed, and President Biden signed the bill into law January the 2nd. This 90-provision, 250-page document will do much more than improve veteran health care. Key provisions include Section 302 brings the same quality of county veteran services I enjoyed in Multnomah County to rural counties and Native territories across the country. Section 143 guarantees access to emergency transportation regardless where a veteran lives. Section 303 protects the loved ones of deceased service members by repealing the outdated law investigating Gold Star spouses for alleged remarriage. Section 301 provides burial services to veterans who die at home while receiving VA hospice care. Section 124 mandates that VA provide detailed information about alternative services to caregivers denied by the caregiver program. Section 120 will increase the reimbursement cap for disabled veterans cared for at home, allowing them to afford life-saving ventilators and other durable equipment while guaranteeing cost savings to taxpayers. Finally, Section 122 offers mental health services to caregivers, vital support to combat burnout and emotional exhaustion. These are just a few highlights of this landmark legislation, which is a boon to our veterans and their caregivers and a testament to their service. Katie's legacy lives on in this progress, but our work is not done because every veteran and caregiver deserves dignity, respect, and support. Sri Benson is a Veterans Health Policy Analyst for the American Legion's Veterans Affairs and Rehabilitation Division and is the author of Why the Dole Act Matters. We're going to move on to militarytimes.com, another one of our military news websites, for this article by Lolita C. Baldor of the Associated Press from the 8th of April. Horse-drawn caissons to return in limited use at Arlington Cemetery. The Army will soon begin limited use of horse-drawn caissons for funerals at Arlington National Cemetery, phasing in the long-held tradition after nearly 2 years of work to improve the care of the horses. Starting June the 2nd, the caissons will be used for 2 funerals per day, up to 10 per week, the Army said. The decision comes as the Army struggles to improve training, get better equipment and facilities, and rebuild the stable of horses after 2 died in 2022 due to poor feed and living conditions. After careful consideration and coordination, we're pleased to reintegrate the caisson conveyance into funeral services at Arlington National Cemetery, a solemn and revered tradition that honors our veterans and service members as they are laid to rest, said Karen Durham Aguilera, Executive Director of the Office of Army Cemeteries and Army National Military Cemeteries. The return of the caissons has been delayed several times. The Army suspended the use of the gray and black horses for the caissons in May 2023 to develop a program to improve the health and conditions of the herd. 2 of the Old Guard platoon horses, Mickey and Tony, had to be euthanized within days of each other in February 2022. Both died of colon impaction. On Tuesday, Major General Trevor Brodenkamp, commander of the Army Military District of Washington, told a small group of reporters that the Army has been working tirelessly with equine experts to buy horses and improve their veterinary care, training, and equipment. He said the Army now has 40 horses and that 33 of those are in 3 squads that would be used for the caissons. Initially, he said, 2 of those squads that had been fully trained and certified will be used for the funerals. He said it is hard to say when the 3rd will be used and how long it will take to get a 4th squad up and operating, because it depends on the ability to find and buy the horses. He said they're largely looking for Percheron or Percheron cross-draft horses that are dark in color and between 6 and 14 years old. 2 squads can do the 10 funerals a week. When 4 squads are fully built and certified and the Fort Myer stable can house 2 of the squads at one time, the cemetery will be able to go up to about 20 caisson funerals a week. That number is still far short of the 30 a week that the cemetery had been doing prior to the problems. Bredenkamp said about $10 million a year is being spent to operate and maintain the program, adding that it costs about $900,000 to buy, train, and equip a squad. Cemetery officials said that in mid-April, visitors will begin seeing the caisson platoon, including the horses and soldiers, around the cemetery as they prepare the horses for duty. During an investigation into the horses' death and condition of the herd, the Army found that there is very little grass in their turnout fields, and they consumed sand and gravel from the ground while eating the low-quality hay they were fed. The fields were littered with construction debris and manure and were only large enough to support six or seven horses, nowhere near the 64 that were using the fields when Mickey and Tony died, the investigation said. A year ago, officials said they were making progress buying new horses, getting better equipment, and improving the training, facilities, and turnout areas. But at the time, Bredenkamp said it was far more time-consuming and difficult than initially expected to get the program going again. He'd warned that it would take an extended period of time to get enough horses to meet the funeral needs. On Tuesday, he said all of the horses in the program in previous years had been retired and all new horses have been acquired. Service members eligible for use of the caisson will include those killed in action, recipients of the Medal of Honor, or the Prisoner of War Medal, all, regardless of rank, as well as senior non-commissioned officers, senior warrant officers, and senior commissioned officers. In addition, they will be available for the funerals of about 25 service members whose families wanted to wait until the caissons returned. In a statement, Renea Yates, acting superintendent of Arlington National Cemetery, said, "Using the caissons in a more limited way will be disappointing to some families, but it allows us to reintegrate our working horses back to the cemetery and safely continue the sacred duty of escorting our nation's heroes to their final resting place." That's horse-drawn caissons to return in limited use at Arlington Cemetery. Well, let's turn now to the newsletter from the Phoenix VA Healthcare System, the newsletter for women veterans, She Served. And it's Welcome to the Spring Edition of She Served, a newsletter designed to keep you informed of VA services, upcoming events, and other newsworthy information. And they say thank you to everyone who joined and participated in our virtual town hall and our February focus group. There's still time to register if you want to participate in the April 28th focus group. This is an opportunity to share your feedback about how the healthcare environment impacts your care. You can register by calling the Women Veterans Program at 602-277-5551, and that's extension 6764. In February, we raised awareness about heart disease in women, which is the number one cause of death in women. In case you missed the activities you can do to help control your risk factors, you can visit www.youtube.com/@PHXVA Healthcare. That's all one word, PHXVA Healthcare, to learn more about what you can do to take control of your health. As we enter the most beautiful time of the year in Arizona, please also be mindful of your sun exposure. Arizona has one of the nation's highest rates of melanoma. Using sunscreen regularly will help protect you from all forms of skin cancer. And this is with gratitude, and signed Kristen Norquist, LCSW, Women's Veterans Program Manager, and Megan Giblin, LCSW Assistant, Women Veterans Program Manager. The Town Hall Poll Results. Thank you to everyone who participated in the March 19th Teletown Hall and responded to our poll questions. For those of you who could not attend the live event, you can view the recording on the Phoenix VA Facebook page. That's available at www.facebook.com/PHXVA XVA Healthcare. You do not need a Facebook account to view the recording. Below are the results of the poll questions that were asked during the town hall. The PVA-HCS has volunteered to participate in the Menopause Veteran Feedback Project. This is a project coordinated through the Women's Health Practice-Based Research Network and is an electronic voluntary survey available to women aged 35 and older. For patients visiting the gynecology clinic at the Carl T. Hayden VAMC from April the 1st through the 29th, please look out for the survey link. The feedback that is received from this survey will be used to help inform national planning efforts related to menopause care. Where are you receiving your menopause-related care? 16% said from a VA facility, 3% from an authorized community care provider, and then 9% from a community provider not authorized, and then 44% said they are not receiving menopause care, and 28% does not apply to me. And then they also asked how you prefer to receive information about services available to women veterans, and 55% of respondents reported electronic options as the preferred method. Lastly, they asked which topic they'd want to hear about during the next town hall. The top three options selected were healthy aging, musculoskeletal conditions, and adaptive sports. They apologize. They were unable to share information during the town hall on VA research opportunities for women. They are planning to present the information during the spring town hall as permitted. My Path. This is contributed by researchers at the VA Puget Sound and the National Office of Women's Health. My Path is a new online resource for veterans to help you find information on birth control, fertility, preparing for a healthy pregnancy, and using the information to help you be prepared to speak with your healthcare team. To speak with your healthcare provider or make an appointment, you can call 602-222-6550, option 2, and then 2. You can visit Women's Health, one word, womenshealth.va.gov for more information on birth control options. My Path. Do you need information or healthcare related to fertility, birth control, or preparing for pregnancy? My Path is a new online resource for veterans that helps you find the birth control method that's right for you. And you can learn about fertility and how to prepare for a healthy pregnancy. Be prepared to talk about these topics with your healthcare team. To talk with a provider about fertility, pregnancy, or birth control, you can contact your primary care clinic to set up an appointment or call the Women's Veterans Call Center, the WVCC, at 855-829-6636 if you're not yet connected to care in the VA. Then they have memorialized your HER story. Thank you to the Military Women's Memorial for allowing us to share the content below. The mission of the Military Women's Memorial is to honor and tell the stories of women, past and present, who serve our nation. The Military Women's Memorial, the only historical repository documenting all military women's service, educates and inspires through innovative and interactive exhibitions, world-class collections, and engaging programs and events for all generations. The Memorial and Education Center was authorized by Congress in 1986, and it is the only national memorial honoring all military servicewomen. It was built with private donations and stands at the ceremonial entrance to Arlington National Cemetery. It is free to share your HER story. Scan the you need to go to womensmemorial.org to register and create your account and learn more and register your story. Then, women veterans, don't hesitate. Screen for colon cancer. Women veterans, 45 and up, it's time to start screening for colon cancer. Colon cancer screening is potentially life-saving and worth it, especially because 90% of colon cancers are preventable with routine screening and a healthy lifestyle. Yet, many women avoid screening due to misunderstandings or hesitations. So, here are five myths you can put to rest. Myth 1. I'm healthy, so I don't need screening. Even if you're in great shape, colon cancer can develop silently. Most colon cancers start as small growths called polyps, which don't usually cause symptoms. Regular screening can detect and remove these polyps before they turn cancerous. The earlier colon cancer is caught, the easier it is to treat, and the better your chances for a full recovery. Veteran fact, VA recommends that women veterans start screening at age 45 even if you feel fine and have no symptoms. If you have risk factors like a family history of colon cancer, your VA healthcare provider may suggest starting earlier. Myth number 2, screening is embarrassing and uncomfortable. We get it. No one looks forward to a medical test, especially a colonoscopy, but taking care of your health is not embarrassing. At VA, your comfort and dignity are our priorities. Your healthcare team will walk you through every step, answering questions and addressing concerns to ensure you feel safe and respected. Plus, you don't always need a colonoscopy right away. Some patients may be able to take at-home option called the fecal immunochemical test, or the FIT, which checks for hidden blood in your stool. Veteran fact, talk with your VA provider about your risk and the appropriate screening method for you. VA will support you at every step. Myth number 3, colon cancer isn't a concern for younger women. While age is the biggest risk factor, colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer deaths among women under 50. Risk factors like family history, obesity, drinking alcohol, smoking, and even your racial or ethnic background can increase your chances of developing it earlier. Veteran fact, screening may not just be for older women. Women veterans of all ages should discuss their risk factors with their VA provider to determine the right screening schedule and test. Myth number 4. I'll know if something's wrong. Colon cancer often develops without symptoms. By the time signs appear, such as blood in your stool, unexplained weight loss, or persistent abdominal pain, the cancer may already be advanced. Veteran fact, regular screenings catch concerns early, often before symptoms arise. Early detection saves lives. Myth number 5, screening is painful. Screening may feel uncomfortable, but anesthesia is used to minimize any discomfort. Your VA healthcare team will walk you through every step and answer any questions regarding preparation for the procedure, what happens during the screening, and recovery. Additionally, with the at-home FIT, screening could be a breeze. Veteran fact, enduring a little discomfort through screening now could prevent major health concerns and distress in the future. Get screened at VA. VA is committed to making colon cancer screening accessible and affordable for women veterans. Whether you're ready for a colonoscopy or starting with a FIT, VA is here to help you take control of your health. Discuss your risk for colon cancer with your VA healthcare provider to determine the best timing and screening test for you. To learn more about screening at VA, visit the VA Women's Health Colonoscopy webpage. If you're experiencing concerning symptoms or not sure when to start colon cancer screening, speak to your VA primary care provider by calling 602-222-6550, option 2, option 2. And just from a personal note here, I know that, first of all, you should consider the fact that this is not just for women. This is something that you gents need to be thinking about as well. And I can tell you that my son, who unfortunately comes from a family, me included, who have developed a number of these precursors to colon cancer, got his screening early at age 45 and had several polyps removed. So age doesn't have to be significant before this can be a life-saving process. So go down, get yourself screened, talk to somebody at the VA or your own physician, and decide whether a colonoscopy or just a test is appropriate for you. We've got time for one more item from that She Served newsletter. Attention women veterans, join the Women Veterans Program to share your feedback about how the VA environment impacts your healthcare experience. So any of you women enrolled in the Phoenix VA Women Veterans, on Monday, April 28th, 2025, from 12 to 1:30 p.m. in person at the Carl T. Hayden VA MC, the Jade Opal Conference Room, D143, 650 East Indian School Road, Phoenix, Arizona, 85012, or you can join virtually using the VA Video Connect. Registration is required. Call the Women Veterans Program to register at 602-277-5551, extension 6764. The Women's Veterans Program is hosting a focus group on April 28th to obtain your feedback about how the VA environment impacts your healthcare experience. Registration is required. And again, that phone number for registering, 602-277-5551, extension 6764. And that is all the time that we have for the Phoenix area newsletter. And this brings this week's edition of Weekly Reveille to an end. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining us for Weekly Reveille and remind you that you can listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app for your phone or tablet from either the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store. And finally, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Alexa, Echo, or Dot.